So I think we left off at Genesis 32 or 3, where Esau was meeting with Jacob. And Jacob, of course, had been reassured by God and is wrestling with him and his name changed and so forth. And it was really, I believe, the beginning of Jacob's conversion, real conversion, where he began to really see God for who he really was. And he began to change profoundly. And he was a different man after that. And as you know, his... I don't know if it was the hollow of the thigh or groin muscle or hip, but anyway, probably for the remainder of his life, he had that as a reminder of what he had done that evening in wrestling directly with God, having prevailed with him and God changing his name. And from that point onward, Jacob's life was changed. He was a different man. But he was still a human being. And this is one of the beauties of the book of Genesis, because it does not hide at all the frailties of its heroes or heroines. It does not hide that at all. Lets you see their shortcomings, their failings, their weaknesses, their trials, their difficulties, their moments in which they lacked faith, and yet they are called men and women of faith. And we see their names in the faith chapter. And they were men and women of faith. But yet they had their moments of humanness and moments of frailty, moments of doubt and fear. And we see this in the life of Jacob, even more so than even with Abraham and Isaac. God lets us really get a real good, you know, look into the life of Jacob and the things that he's gone through, as we already have gone through in the study, how he fails in trusting God for the birthright, takes matters to his own hands. Then he goes to be with his uncle Laban, and he gets married. But he has a battle there, a trial there, because it turns out that Laban is even more deceitful than he is. So he has that battle that he has to deal with. He ends up having two wives, which he only should have had one, and he could have brokered that deal properly if he truly trusted God. But he didn't at that point, so he ended up with two. And from a contractual situation, he couldn't really get out of it. But then he ends up with a couple of concubines on top of that. Battle of the conceptions between both wives, and then concubines on either side. And I tell you, it just became a real mess. Just a real mess. You know. So then he has some legal children. Then he has illegitimate children. And as you will see, as we're about to get into, this also brings about jealousy among the brothers. And it brings about infighting among the brothers. And that exists even until this very day, which is amazing, rather amazing, having gone down through history like that. And we still see today, you know, if we are correct in our belief, and I believe we are, that France, particularly northern France, is predominantly Reuben. Reuben, as we will read even here, as we go through the book of Genesis, develops a definite, real bad thing of jealousy toward Joseph and, you know, his brother. And he was the firstborn. He was the one to whom the birthright legally was supposed to go to. But God changed that whole scenario, as we'll see later on. And we see the same thing today. Reuben is still jealous of Joseph today. Look how the French fight the United States so hard on everything, you know, about this whole Iraq situation. The French have given them more difficulties than just about anybody. And they're brothers. They're brothers, but the French have really given them a very hard time. But that's a whole other story, and I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. We'll get into the specific prophecies when we get near the end of Genesis on each one of these brothers and where they basically are today. Yes? Basically, primarily Ephraim and Manasseh, which is Great Britain and the United States. We'll get into that a little bit, although Ephraim, as we will see in a moment, actually, in a couple more moments, was to be a company of nations. And they have ended up indeed being a company of nations, because the Ephraimites spread out. It's amazing, that tiny little island. You just think about it. A tiny little island literally spread out all over the globe, and there are more Ephraimites all around the rest of the world than there is in England. It's an amazing thing. Yes, Gunnar.
Reminded me of the sun never sets on the British Empire.
Right. Well, it used to be.
Yeah,
but
that's what
they mean. But yeah, you're right. For a long, long time, that was the case. Up until about World War II. Then in the 50s, they began to lose their empire. But then on the other hand, in a sense, you might say they still got it because most of those nations that were part of the British Empire became Commonwealth members, and so they still have a certain allegiance to the crown, although they are not, you know, exclusively under the crown anymore. They're independent nations, but they do have treaties with England that they honor. Usually whenever England goes to war, as we see even in the case of the Iraqi situation, you have the Australians, South Africans, New Zealanders are all also, by the way, committing to that war. And the reason why is because of their relationship with England, with the United Kingdom. And Canadians also, and India as well, that's right. I think they call them the Burkas or something like that. Yeah, they're all committed in that particular way, so you end up having these different groups that England still has a great deal of influence with, even though they're not exclusively under England's crown anymore. But the British Empire, in a sense, in a way, you could say it still exists, in a way. But let's go on now to chapter 34. We'll start at the end of 33 and then go to 34, because that's where we were right at the end of 33. We had looked at the situation with Jacob reconciling with Esau, and God gave him favor in Esau's sight, which was a miracle. Some years prior to that, Esau wanted to kill him. But now Esau comes and he shows nothing but humility and love and warmth toward his brother. There's a proverb, and I wish they had written it down and thought about it before now, that where it says, you know, God would even make your enemies to be at peace with you. I'm not sure if it's Proverbs or not. It may be one of the Psalms. I'm not sure. But anyway, it's true. And we can see in this situation, God did that with Jacob. He even made his enemies to be at peace with him. And I've had that experience on more than one occasion. For there are those whom I know wanted to get me. And then it turns around. It ended up, like I think I mentioned before, the one individual who was, he was an open racist and admitted it openly. Didn't try to hide it. And used to literally persecute me every day. And use foul language around me. And I put up with that. And this guy ultimately came to a point where I was his only ally. I was his only ally. And he even came to a dinner I gave for the brother. Mom may remember that dinner I gave. It was over my Aunt Kate's home. And did you come to that, Mom, that dinner? You remember it? Most of the church came out for it, a large number. It was mostly for young people, that's right. So, it was mostly for the younger folks. And we did a little Oriental thing where we had to wear some Oriental clothes, and we actually made little wooden Japanese tables. Did you come to that?
Yeah.
You did? And we cooked Oriental food and everything. And it was really a very, very nice thing. And I was talking to some people at the job about this dinner we're going to have that weekend, and I was really looking forward to it, and he overheard me and asked, could he come? And he came. This guy who was an avowed racist. And it was, at that time, mostly only African-American brethren that were at this dinner. He can't hear, he is sitting there, this avowed racist. And he even made a little joke. He said, you know, I don't know what to talk about. I'm so used to talking about race, politics and sex, and I get the feeling I can't talk about any of them, but, you know. Gunner.
Proverbs 16:7
about God making for those who are his, he'll make your enemies to be at peace with you. And God actually did that with me, with this individual. I even had a situation where the job I had at that time or after that time where I was had to inspect different emergency services around the state of Michigan, and there was a guy who I had to inspect, and he was mafioso, literally. And God gave me favor in his eyes, because I had to write up a a violation. He owned one of the largest funeral homes in Detroit at that time. May have been the largest on the east side of Detroit. And at that time, many of the funeral homes in Detroit were also ambulance services as well. Quite a conflict of interest. And the state of Michigan had made new laws to try to separate that. And my job was to go around and evaluate the situation, cite those different ones who were in violation. And I was there to cite this guy for being in violation. This guy was mafioso of the mafia. And he was open about it and free about it, too, as well. And then he even told me, you seem like a nice young man. You don't have to really write this violation up. And he was right, I didn't. Because I didn't write it up. But I said, he said, we will set you up. He says, look, I know people at the racetrack. I can set you up. You can go down there and you can win X amount of money, you know. And I said, oh, yeah, okay. So he said, I know other people with the state, you know, with the racing commission. I could get you a job in the racing commission, and you can make a whole lot more money there than you're making right now this job you got. And I said, And I said, well, look, we don't have to write this up right now. I wrote up my report, but I did not cite him at that point in time, and I told my boss about it. And they decided to leave him alone too at the time. So the decision was in their hands, and they decided to leave him alone too at the time. I don't know whatever happened to him, but I wasn't going back there. I wasn't going back there ever again. But he liked me. I mean, he actually liked me. You know, sat, took me up to his he had his house over the funeral home. And took me up there to his office, made me coffee, sat down, and, you know, just as pleasant. This is nice. I guess he probably would have pulled out his gun just as pleasantly, though, yeah. But anyway, God is able to give us favor. And as you look at Jacob, you see that constantly. This man was in a land of nothing but Canaanites all around him. And it was a trial, brother. It was not an easy thing for Jacob. It was very, very difficult. And you're going to see some more lessons that we're about to get into now. At the end of chapter 33, Jacob says he erected an altar at this particular town. And he called it El Elohi Israel, which means the mighty God of Israel. And this is where Jacob was, you know, recognizing how great God was. He had wrestled with him. Now he had reconciliation with his brother. He knew that God was in his favor. He knew he had God's grace, and he worshiped him, the mighty God of Israel, he said. Of course, we should be saying the same thing. The mighty God of Bertha, the mighty God of Tamsuve, the mighty God of Carly, the mighty God of Lionel. We should be able to say the same thing about our God as we draw closer and closer to him. You are my God. And we know him in that kind of relationship. And this is the kind of relationship that Jacob is growing into with God. He's growing. We're seeing this growth process. It's beautiful to observe. But there's more growth to come. It's not over yet. So we get to chapter 34 now. And this is an interesting story. And the way the book of Genesis, you know, flows in this story pattern, you could take it for just sort of a Bible bedtime story. And a lot of people do. And they miss all of the insights that are just beneath the surface. Right there. We're trying to dig out just a few of them as we go through the story. And Dinah, the daughter of Leah, which she bare unto Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. Now, this little, short little statement is very revealing. She became curious as to the ways of the society around her. She also was lonely because there was no other girls to talk to. She's the only girl in the family. There are 12 boys. She's the only daughter. And also she is being quite independent here and going off on her own. It seems that there's some degree of neglect that has taken place here to allow her to go into a village of Canaanites by herself. What's going on here? How did it come to this point? where she could do this. Did someone miss her? Where was father and mother at? I don't know how much time passed between verse 29 of chapter 33 and verse 1 of chapter 34, but some time has passed between these two. The Bible doesn't let us know how much time. And during this period of time, we see another lapse on the part of Jacob. I'll show it to you in a moment. Another lapse on the part of Jacob. And Jacob's getting older, too. You know, you get old and you get a little tired. You get older and you just get a little bit tired. And so sometimes you just don't have quite the diligence to deal with some things like you really should. But God doesn't let that be an excuse, though. But sometimes that happens. And it appears that this was happening in the case of Dinah. And I'm kind of wondering, how many other times has she already been out to this town? This may not have been the first time. The Bible doesn't tell us. She may have visited before. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and defiled her, or he really forced her, raped her. But it appears, you kind of get the feeling that even though this was a forced situation on his part, somehow I get the feeling that she was like kind of put herself into a situation in which this was brought about. Now, I don't want to sound like those male chauvinists of the day, you know, that the women's liberation groups are hound all the time and say, yeah, that's just like you men, you say it's always the woman's fault. Well, no, it wasn't always her fault, but it appears that she put herself in a compromising situation. And this guy, of course, lost self-control and took advantage of it. It forced her. And the word defiled means humbled her. And his soul cleaved unto Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the damsel. So the word loved here is more in respect to sexual desire and attachment. He became attached to her. And cleaved unto Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the damsel and spake kindly unto her. So he wanted to make her his wife. And Shechem spake unto his father Hamor, saying, get me this damsel to wife. And Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah his daughter. Now his sons were with his cattle in the field, and Jacob held his peace until they were come. And Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out unto Jacob to commune with him. And the sons of Jacob came out of the field when they heard it, and the men were grieved, and they were very angry, because he had wrought folly in Israel in lying with Jacob's daughter, which thing ought not to be done. Not only the fact that it was a forcible rape in this case, but also because Israel was not supposed to be amalgamated with the Canaanites. It were to remain distant from the Canaanites. And here was a Canaanite that had actually forced Dinah. And of course, God had even given instructions to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob. But as we go down the line, we see each generation is getting just a little bit more lax. And Jacob, in this case, has gotten a little lax. And then when we get to the sons of Jacob, it gets even a little more lax. We'll get to that in a moment. But they knew though, and they understood, and they were taught. And they were all circumcised, and everybody they were in the midst of were not circumcised. So they knew how it was supposed to be. And verse 8, and Hamor communed with them, saying, the soul of my son Shechem longeth for your daughter. I pray you give her him to wife, and make you marriages with us, and give your daughters unto us, and take our daughters unto you. And you shall dwell with us, and the land shall be before you. Dwell and trade you therein, and get you possessions therein. So what they're proposing is that they become one people. But they're not exactly totally without some deceit too. We'll get to that in a moment. They have their little bit of deceit in all this too. And it goes on. And Shechem said unto her father and to her brother, let me find grace in your eyes, and what you shall say unto me, I will give. He was a little bit more honorable in some respects, even though he had forced her. He shouldn't have done that. That was a terrible thing to do. But he seems to have had at least some honor, some small degree of honor. Ask me never so much dowry and gift, and I will give according as you shall say unto me, but give me the damsel to wife. And the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and his father deceitfully. You know, they used some little con game here. And said, because he had, and the sons of Jacob asked him deceitfully, and said, because he had defiled Dinah, their sister. And they said unto them, we cannot do this thing to give our sister to one that is uncircumcised, for that is a reproach unto us. But in this will we consent unto you, if you will be as we are, that every male of you be circumcised. See, they had a plan. They had a plan. Then will we give our daughters unto you, and we will take your daughters unto us, and we will dwell with you, and we will become one people. But if you will not hearken unto us to be circumcised, then we will take our daughter, and we will be gone. And we'll just leave. Of course, that wasn't their intent. We know that. But they were pulling off a pretty good con job here. And the young man deferred not, or I should say, in verse 18, and their words pleased Hamor, and Shechem, Hamor's son. And the young man deferred not to do the thing because he had delight in Jacob's daughter, and he was more honorable than all the house of his father. Well, that wasn't saying a whole lot for his whole house when he had actually raped her. But it does show he did have some honor. But the rest of them really didn't. And Hamor and Shechem, his son, came into the gate of their city and communed with the men of their city, saying, these men are peaceable with us. Therefore, let them dwell in the land and trade therein. For the land, behold, is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters to us for wives, and let us give them our daughters. Only herein will the men consent unto us for to dwell with us, to be one people, if every male among us be circumcised as they are circumcised. Then he says this, shall not their cattle and their substance, and every beast of theirs be ours. So you see, they weren't without deceit too. In other words, we'll let them become one people with us, and all of their possessions will become ours. Their wealth and their riches will become ours. So they weren't without deceit. This was a dangerous situation that was about to take place here. This was actually a threat to the existence of the continuance of Israel. Dangerous situation. Then he goes on, verse 24, and unto Haman, unto Shechem, and his son hearken all that went out of the gate of his city. Now you have to understand, it wasn't a city like Detroit, so we're not talking about a million people. It probably was a small village, maybe of a few hundred people, maybe. How many, I don't know. But possibly a few hundred people in this village. And it came, and it says, and every male was circumcised, all that went out of the gate of the city. And it came to pass on the third day when they were sore, that two of the sons of Jacob, and I had a good friend some years ago in his 30s get circumcised. And let me tell you, it is best to do it when you're a little baby, a few days old. Because he was in absolute agony for some days. He could not get out of bed. He couldn't leave the house. And finally, he had to be taken to the hospital. He got infection and everything. I mean, it was just, it seems to be when a child is circumcised, particularly on the eighth day, that I believe they say the vitamin K in the blood comes to its peak about the eighth day, where it will heal very rapidly. But for a grown person, it is a little different. And you can have a hard time stopping the bleeding. And it could be a very painful and terrible situation. So these guys, in effect, were incapacitated. And the sons of Israel knew this would be the case. They would be completely incapacitated. They wouldn't be able to do a thing. Came to pass on the third day when they were sore that two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brethren, took each man his sword and came upon the city boldly and slew all the males. I'm sure they had some more with them, probably other servants. But those two led this situation. They were at the lead of it. And it tells you something, as we'll get into it later, about Simeon and Levi. They had a very vengeful nature. If it is true, and I believe it is, that Simeon, as the prophecy that Jacob gave, they would be scattered throughout Israel, and if it's true that much of or some significant degree of your Scots and Northern Irish are Simeon, it kind of makes sense, especially when you look at Northern Ireland. And there's a big difference, by the way, in Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. You notice the Republic of Ireland is not the same like that. But in Northern Ireland, it's turmoil, tumult. And it still is. And I don't believe they'll ever completely solve that situation. Why? Maybe many of them are Simeonites. Same with certain parts of Scotland, not all, but parts of Scotland are Simeonites as well. And of course, as we know, the Stone of Scone that was taken from Ireland was in Northern Ireland, by the way, where the kingly line of the Irish was in Northern Ireland, and it went over into Scotland because they're, you know, very close together there. Just a little short trip across the water over Scotland. And they were allies at one time. So it may have been the same people. And maybe one reason why God scattered them throughout Israel is because it's just too violent to be, all be in one country together totally, you know. It's a little better to kind of, you know, kind of disperse them and water them down a little bit. Because they could create some havoc. And don't get those guys mad. Because they stay mad for generations. They pass the anger on down to the next generation, and just never get over it. You know, you see that like with your in Bosnia and what's the other country over there? The Serbians, and they're similar in that respect. They have anger and wrath and bitterness that is passed on from child to child, generation to generation. They never get over it. Yes, Gunnar.
And many of those people settled in the southern half of the United States.
I've heard that. That may very well be true. I don't know if that's true or not.
Yes, they did.
Well, I know a lot of Scots did go to the southern part of the United States.
They were convicts.
Oh, were they really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a lot of them out of the Kima colony in Georgia.
Well, we're not going to, I love the South. I do, sincerely. So. Yeah, the Hatfields and McCoys is another example of that. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, McCoy, this is kind of, is that a Scottish name? So I don't know. You may be right. I don't know, and I ain't going to get into that. All I know is that Simeon is certainly scattered throughout Israel, and Levi also is scattered, although you will tend to find more of your Levites among the Jewish people. There are many of your Jews that are Levites, priests. They even have names like Kohan, which is a Hebrew word for priest, by the way. So there are many of them that are scattered among the Jews. But Levi and Simeon were two fierce tribes. But see, you have to understand something. Now, they were not right in their deceit and what they did. But remember now, as we read through Genesis, who's in charge? Who is sovereign? God, right? Who's allowing this to take place? God, right? And why is he allowing this to take place? Because this was a dangerous moment. Now, God could have prevented it some other way. But you see, sometimes God lets things done a certain way to teach lessons on the other side, too. And there were some things that were being done wrong. Some things being done wrong by Jacob, and some things that were being done wrong by the sons and the children and Jacob's entire tribe, just about. And we're going to get into that in just a moment. Because I was looking at this, I said, why did God allow that to happen? Why? And I said, boy, it seems so terrible. And you know, because he had protected them, so to protected Jacob and given him all this wonderful favor, and now all of a sudden he allows his daughter to get raped? And it just seemed like such a terrible thing, and I had a little problem with God there for about 30 seconds. And then I said, well, why, God, did you allow that to happen to his daughter? But you'll see in a moment why God allowed that to happen. And it's a lesson for us, as everything in Genesis is. Tremendous lesson for us. So we'll go down and read some more. And they came upon the and Jacob's sons, and they slew Hamor and Shechem his son with the edge of the sword, and took Dinah out of Shechem's house and went out. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain and spoiled the city because they had defiled their sister. They took their sheep, their oxen, their asses, and that which was in the city and that which was in the field. And all their wealth, remember they was going to take all their wealth, God had all their wealth. See, God would have done this anyway. You understand, brother, that God would have done this anyway? But he allowed it to be done through human carnality at this point because of some lessons that had to be learned. And all their wealth and all their little ones and their wives took their captives. So they took their wives and spoiled even all that was in their house. I mean, they just devastated this place. And Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, you have troubled me to make me stink among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. Perizzites, I think that's it. I said Perizzites. Perizzites. But maybe they were Perizzites. I don't know. And I being few in number, they shall gather themselves together against me and slay me, and shall be destroyed, I and my house. And they said to him, should he deal with our sister as with a harlot? They spoke up to Jacob. You can see that they didn't even care what their father thought in this situation. So there was even some degree of a loss of honor among the sons of Jacob, even toward him. Something had gone wrong in this period of time from chapter 33 to here. Something had happened. And there was even a loss of some respect, even to Jacob, that took place here. Well, the answer is in the next chapter, chapter 35. So now Jacob is scared. Jacob's faith is once again being challenged. Once again, we see his humanness come into play. Once again, he's afraid. He's even saying to them, what's going to happen to me? They're going to, you know, the people are going to mount up together. They're going to destroy us. That's a pretty drastic, you know, turn of events. Before, he was El Elohe, the mighty God of Jacob, of Israel. Now, what's going to happen to us? They're going to destroy us, and he's afraid, and he's discouraged. Don't we all go through that time and time again? One day we're just filled with the Spirit, and we're ready to go out and just destroy the Philistines. And then the next day we're running from just the sound of something that seemed like it might be bad. It's the way we are humanly. And Jacob was no different than us. And yet, God was still with him. Look what God does. It was God who allowed this situation to take place, brethren. It was God who allowed it to be a chastisement unto Jacob. A chastisement unto Jacob. And God said unto Jacob, arise, go up to Bethel, and dwell there, and make there an altar unto God, unto Elohim, that appeared unto you when you fled from the face of Esau, your brother. Now, why did God say it that way? You can tell me, can't you? Why did he say it like that? Anybody remember? Remember, it was Bethel when Jacob was running from Esau. And that's where he slept at, where he saw the vision of the angels going up and down the staircase, and where he anointed the stone there. Remember that? And called it, named it Bethel, which meant house of God. God tells him to go back there. And you know, it's that way in every one of our lives. God sometimes has us go back to where he started us out, to get our attention, to remind us of our calling, to remind us what he gave us, remind us of how he's dealt with us. Because why? We all forget. It's just human nature. We forget, we get bogged down in our trials, different experiences. We forget how God dealt with us before. We forget how he's called us. We forget how he's intervened in different situations. So he has to take us back. And he does that. And God takes Jacob back to Bethel. Say, go up here to Bethel, where you ran away from Esau. Now you're up here crying about these people, how they're going to kill you and do this to you. In other words, God is saying, in essence, haven't I protected you, taken care of you? What did I do? What did I do when you were at Bethel? Didn't I show you how close I was nearby? This is what God is telling him. Let's go on further. Then Jacob said unto his household, now listen to this, brother. Then Jacob said unto his household and to all that were with him, all that were with him, put away the strange gods that are among you. Ah, there's a reason for this madness. Jacob's family had fallen into idolatry. That included his sons, his servants, probably his daughter Dinah. Maybe she was even curious about their ways down there of idolatrous worship. And Jacob had allowed the situation to get out of hand. He wasn't dealing with it. He knew better, but he wasn't dealing with it for whatever reason. Why he wasn't, I don't know. But he had become very lax. And there is one thing, brethren, one thing that God, I'm telling you, will intervene and he will punish us. When we begin to allow idols into our lives and put them in the place of God, we inevitably are asking for God to spank us. Now, for the people who don't belong to God, it doesn't matter. But to you whom he has chosen and covenanted with, it matters greatly. And he will spank you. He'll let you go for a while in that direction, hoping that you will finally come to see without him having to take a drastic measure. But at some point, before he loses you, he will intervene and he will spank you when you go in that direction. And God will not, let me tell you something about God, he will not share his sovereignty and worship with anything or anybody. He will not share it. And if you're putting anything before God that you worship it, that you adore or lust after, whatever it might be, and you put that before God, God will take it away from you. He will. And in this particular situation, God allowed the daughter of Dinah. You know, I have to believe that Jacob probably doted on Dinah quite a bit. It was his only daughter at the time. Probably doted on her a lot. But he also had let her get away with a lot of stuff too, you know, because she was the only daughter, probably let her have her way in a lot of things. She became very independent in certain ways, and she went out to spy out the land on her own, and plus this idol, they had these idols all throughout the camp. They had allowed the influence of the Canaanites to come in. Now they were coming close to the point of even becoming amalgamated among the Canaanites. That would have been the end of Israel. And the main reason it would have been the end of Israel is not just because of physically loss of physical identity, but because of the idolatry. The idolatry and the way of life of the Canaanites. And there would have been no preservation of the true God. So God allowed this to come upon Jacob. Put away the strange gods that are among you and be clean and change your garments. Meaning, be clothed with righteousness. Jacob realized why this happened. God no doubt revealed it to him. And he's repenting. And he's going to his family and he's telling them in a very urgent way, get the idols out of here. Get them out. Not tomorrow. Not in the next minute, but right now. Get them out. And let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make there an altar unto God who answered me in the day of my distress and was with me in the way which I went. Got to go back to my roots. Back to my roots. And they gave unto Jacob all the strange gods which were in their hand and all their earrings which were in their ears. So they had little earring idol gods. Little idol gods, you know. They had put, you know, where did they get that from? From the Canaanites. That influence that was all around them. And they were succumbing to it. That influence was there. No doubt, probably Dinah wore some little idolatrous earrings. They got involved in all this. Amazing. Which were in their ears. And Jacob hid them under the oak which was by Shechem. And they journeyed, and the terror of God was upon the cities that were round about them, and they did not pursue after the sons of Jacob. God put that terror. It wasn't just only because of what the sons of Jacob did, but God puts that terror on them. Because it says what? The terror of God. So it was a terror that God placed. He put a fear in them. They were afraid to pursue. So Jacob came to Luz, which is in the land of Canaan, that is Bethel. He and all the people that were with him. And he built there an altar and called the place, and this is interesting, El Bethel. Now before, it was just Bethel, right? House of God. But now he says El Bethel, meaning the God of the house of God. Another lesson Jacob is learning. Not only the house of God, but he is the God of the house of God. We are to have God in our house, period. If we are to go into the house of God, we must recognize that he's the God of that house. And therefore, when you go into someone else's house, you do what they determine that you do in their house. When Jacob realizes he's in the house of God, he can allow his family to do all this stuff. God is the God of the house of God. And the scripture says what? We are the house of God. And if we are the house of God, should we have idols in his house? No. No, we shouldn't. So he builds the El Bethel, and because there God appeared to him when he fled from the face of his brother. But Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died, and she was buried beneath Bethel under an oak. And the name of it was called Alam Bakchuth. And I don't know what that means. I didn't look that one up. Maybe someone else might be able to see it, what it means.
My Bible has the oak of weeping.
The oak of weeping? Okay, maybe so. Oak of weeping. And I guess they were weeping for her. And God appeared to Jacob again when he came out of Padan Aram and blessed him. And God said unto him, thy name is Jacob. Thy name shall not be called anymore Jacob, but Israel. Well, he had already told him that before. You see, he's reminding him again. You were changed. And you can't go back to the old Jacob. In fact, you're not Jacob anymore. I wonder what our names are now. You know, our names have been changed too. God hasn't told us specifically yet what they are, but our names have been changed. We have new names that are going to be given to us, and our names have been changed, just like it was for Jacob. And God calls those things what they are. And see, Jacob is no longer Jacob, even though the Jacob flesh was still there. But in the eyes of God, he's no longer Jacob. Because what does it say in Romans? God calls those things that are not as if they were. So in the eyes of God, he sees us for what we are yet to be, not what we are now. And in his mind, it is as if we already were. That's the way he looks at us. So I wonder what our names are. You know, it's a funny thing. Whenever I think of my name Lionel, I don't relate to that name. I really don't. I don't relate to the name. It's sort of a sound. You know what I'm saying? I respond to it because, you know, it's all I know about right now, you know. But I don't relate to the name. Especially after some 30-some-odd years in the Church of God, I definitely don't relate to who Lionel was 30-something years ago. If for no other reason, I'm older. I've changed outside and inside. So I just kind of wonder, what is my name going to be? I mean, have you ever thought about it? I mean, what are our names going to be? What has God named you? Because we have a new name that we're going to receive. And God is reminding Jacob of that fact. He had the privilege of knowing his name right then. That's the name he carries on into the kingdom of God. Israel. See, he had his name. Abraham's name was changed. And that name, to the glory of God, will continue. Father of the faithful. To the glory of God. So God has given them their names and made known to them, and he's also given a name to us that we don't know yet just what it is. We probably couldn't pronounce it right now. We have to wait until we have supernatural dialect to be able to pronounce it. Going on here. So he reminds him of his name. Verse 11, God said to him, I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall be of thee, and kings shall come out of your loins. This here has been repeated a number of times, but here to Jacob is repeated in a different kind of way. In other instances in which it was repeated, it dealt in a dual way, not only with the children and descendants of Abraham, but also with the spiritual descendants of Abraham. Here, though, is dealing with it primarily and only from a physical standpoint of a nation and company of nations. Two different groups of peoples that would come out of Israel, that would be prominent in Israel. One would be a singular great nation. The other would be a company of nations. And we've seen that fulfilled really in the last 100 years with the United States coming into its glory during the 20th century as the singular most greatest powerful nation that the world has ever seen. And with the British Commonwealth, the United Kingdom coming to the point of a company of nations called a Commonwealth of Nations. And when we understand who Joseph is and where the children of Joseph went to, and that can be traced, I don't want to get into all the details of that. I'll let you all do that yourselves, or we could always have Steve, what's Steve's last name? Collins come back again and have him go through all those details, and there's enough for you to read on your own on that. And books like The Lost Ten Tribes of Israel, Judith Scepter, and can't remember the full name of the book, and Joseph Birthright, right. And you can read those books. If anyone doesn't have those books, let me know, and you can I'll let you borrow the ones I have, and you can read those and get that information where you can trace the history of Israel, where they traveled to after their captivity, trace their migrations from the land of Israel taken by the Assyrians, for instance, and taken over into the area between the Black and Caspian Sea, where the Assyrian Empire was located. And then from there, as the Assyrian Empire migrated across the Caucasoid Mountains or across the straits of that isthmus, I'm trying to think of that isthmus between Turkey and Europe, the Bosphorus Strait, yeah, that migrated in those two different directions. The Bosphorus Strait in the south and the Caucasoid Mountains toward the north between the Black and Caspian Sea. It's a good idea to get a map and look at some of these things. You know, just to familiarize yourself. It's a good thing to trace. This is why the Bible puts all that stuff in there. Because God actually wants us, you know, to look at this stuff in the Bible, take out a map, and just run your finger over it, you know, from where they started out, and just go across the hills and go into Europe. So you get the feel for what God has done. What he's doing. Yes.
I was reading the book of Ruth, and what you say is really important, because it wasn't until I got to find out that Ruth was a Moabite, I said, well, if she's a Moabite and descendant of Lot, then the Lord will accept me too.
Well, yeah, of course.
You know, I mean, he's just not accepting Israel, you know.
Absolutely not.
All, you
That's
know,
true.
Doing that research going back to Moses.
That's true. And of course, I hope we've been making that clear as we've been going through this, that it's not all about Israel. Israel is the foundation. And it's through that foundation that God is opening up salvation unto the whole world. That's all. It's a simple thing. You build a building. You have to start out with a foundation. You have no foundation, the building can't stand. I mean, that's just simple mathematics. God is the one who created engineering techniques and mathematics. And he's very logical in the way he does things. Well, I don't know, it might not be to our human mind sometimes, but he does things in a sound-minded way. He's the God of organization. He knows how to organize to get things done in a perfect way. So he establishes a nation. He establishes a people. He uses that people to preserve knowledge of him. He uses that people to be signposts within the Bible so that the Bible can be validated. You understand what I just said, brother? He uses them as signposts in the Bible so that the Bible can be validated. How? Well, you know, if you put down here about a particular people, and this is what you're going to do for those people, and this is how those people are going to be down through the ages, this is how they're going to be at the end time, this is what they're going to look like, what they're going to act like, what they're going to accomplish, and you have this in the Bible, and you see it happen, what does that do? You say, there must be a God. There must be a God. And this book must be true. First time when I first came to church and was gaining that knowledge about Israel and reading the different books and booklets and correspondence courses and all the things we had back then, I tell you, it was one of the most fascinating things I ever read. I was just completely enthralled and couldn't put it down. And I said, this is unbelievable. I mean, it was believable. I mean, you know what I mean. I said, this is awesome. And I could see it. It was clear as a bell. You could see what was in the Bible. You could see what God said. Then you look at the histories. Then you could see the migration. You could see the whole picture. And you just, all you could do is just your tongue drop out and you say, wow. Because you see what God has been working out and how He's working out His plan. And I don't know about you, but what that does for me, it gives me confidence in the Word of God. And confidence to trust Him in keeping all of His promises. You know, a God who's kept a promise like that, thousands of years old. Let's go back. How old is this promise? How far back do we go? When was the time of Abraham? Sometime around 4000 BC or a little later, maybe like what, 3700 BC or something like that? Or I'm sorry, 2800 BC. Yeah, something like that. 2800 BC. What I was thinking in terms of it is it being like between 3,500 and 4,000 years ago? 1,800 BC? Well, actually, it was like 2,700, 2,800 BC, yeah. Because it was like children of Israel, when they came out of Egypt, was like 1,500 BC, somewhere thereabout. Then you had a total of like 430 years prior to that when they came out, so then that would have been like about 1,900 or 2,000 BC. And when you go back to Abraham, then you go from the time of Abraham being born, so that would have been another 175 years prior to that. So it's somewhere around 2200 BC when Abraham was born. Something like that. I don't know. I'm probably off on the exact figures. Yes?
Well, I figured I got 1972.
1972 BC? Okay, so how much time totally does that give us? That gives us like a total of almost 4,000 years? That's what I was trying to get at, really. It's the total amount of time. It's the total amount of time is something like 3,900, between 38 and 3,900 years ago that God began to make this covenant and carry it out and preserving it and committed to it all that time. Well, I think that's reliable. I think that's pretty reliable. Yes.
I think it goes back to the Garden of Eden.
Well, yeah, it does, because of the promise made about the promised seed.
The promise, not the actual covenant with any person, but the promise.
But the promise, true, it does. So now we're talking almost 6,000 years. That's quite a commitment. That is quite a commitment. So when I read these things, that's what I see. I see God's faithfulness and His being reliable and committed. And I look at the prophecies. You know, you really cannot appreciate prophecy without understanding about who Israel is today. There are some people who want to throw that knowledge out today, and I think it's unfortunate. They want to, you know, kick it to the wayside. Or they may be offended by it, and they don't want to deal with it. But you really cannot fully appreciate the prophecies in the Bible without understanding who Israel is. Yes, Mike.
J.H. Allen, in his book, Judah's Scepter, Joseph's Birthright, he made the point that people who are looking for these promises to be fulfilled in Judah only, they have not been fulfilled in Judah. And he gave the example of a couple people who realized that, and they lost their faith. Because they seen those promises, they saw they were not fulfilled in Judah, and they lost their faith. I think he gave the example of one man, or there was one or two men that he gave.
I remember that, yeah.
And so he made the point that seeing these promises fulfilled in the modern age, it proves, you know, exactly what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
You see God's hand fulfilling.
Exactly. Exactly. I agree. I remember reading that. I can't remember the particular people that he pointed out, but you're right. They lost their faith because they were looking only at Judah as being all of Israel, and they didn't see those promises fulfilled with Judah, which they're not, because Judah is not the birthright nation. The birthright did not go to Judah. The promised seed, the line of the kingly line, went to Judah, as we'll see later, and most of you already know anyway. But the birthright did not go to Judah. Birthright went to Joseph. The sons of Joseph, more specifically, Ephraim and Manasseh. That's where it went to. And so therefore, in the prophecies about there would always be a king to sit upon the throne over Israel, some part of Israel would have a king down through the ages. You can't see that with Judah. So if you apply that prophecy to Judah, it would break scripture. So you got to go elsewhere. You got to go elsewhere. And of course that is revealed as we study history, and we see how what happened with Jeremiah. We'll get into that later. But as we see what happened with Jeremiah and how the kingly line, and in fact we're getting ready to get into a very important aspect that deals with that. We'll go on here. Do we have time? Yeah, we got quite a little bit of time yet. So he tells him, "In the land which I gave Abraham and Isaac to thee will I give it, and to your seed after thee will I give the land." So God promises this land unto Jacob, yet Jacob died never having that land. Remember, Jacob went into Egypt, in fact, at the end of his life and stayed there for the remainder of his life and died there. So Jacob never got this land. So this is a prophecy in the future when Jacob will have this land. He and Isaac and Abraham resurrected together. And they will have leadership and rulership in that land. And Abraham has been promised to inherit the whole earth. So Abraham is really going to have a very prominent position with Christ, where he's going to share a rulership with Christ of the entire earth. And Jacob is going to be in Israel, and Isaac there, in some rulership capacity there in Israel. And then, of course, as we go down the line, there are others like David. We know David is going to be king over all the 12 tribes. We know that each one of the apostles, Christ said himself, that each one of them will be given rulership over one of the tribes. So you got David over the 12 tribes. Then you've got each of the apostles singularly over a tribe. Then over David is Jacob. And then over Jacob is Isaac. And over Isaac is Abraham. Abraham over all the entire earth. So there are positions of responsibility, rulership, and God. And see, the thing is, there are a lot of them. God hasn't named the other ones yet. We're working for those right now. You know, maybe who knows? Maybe he'll put Carly over Berlin. Maybe, I don't know. Be over the tribe of the Berlinese or something. No, maybe I'll be over the Kenyans, I don't know. But each of us right now are being developed right now, just as Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were being developed, are being developed for rulership in the kingdom of God. And in a leading position. So God makes this promise to Jacob, but he didn't get it right then. This is in the future. But he says, "I will give it to you, and to your seed after you will I give it." Well, they had it after him, but temporarily they didn't keep it. And even right now, there's only one tribe there. And that one tribe, Judah, only has a very small slither of land there. They don't even have all of what God gave them originally. Just a little sliver. But unfortunately, the Arabs, they're going to find out that all that land's been intended for somebody else. And they're going to be moved out of that land completely and totally. In fact, most of them are even going to be wiped out. And we've gone and dealt with some of those prophecies back in Ezekiel. They are going to be wiped out. When you read what God says about Ishmael and Esau, which are the two dominant peoples there in the Middle East, your Ishmaelites and your Edomites, they're going to be completely wiped out. And they're not going to occupy that land. That's coming. Then they're going to find out, you know, who God really is. Who he really is at that time. Going on. And God went up from him in that place where he talked with him. So here, once again, you notice that each experience that Jacob is having, he's closer and closer to God. God is allowing him to have even more intimate experience with him each time. You know, it should be that way with us. Not so much that you see God. I mean, it'd be a nice experience to have that, but that's not necessary, really. As we go through our various different trials and experiences, we should come out of those things closer to God, seeing him more and more through each trial, through each experience. More profoundly knowledgeable of him, deeper in our faith than before. That's what's supposed to happen to us. And even though we fail, even though we have all these frailties, just like Jacob, just like him, each time you go through those failures, but you haven't given up, and you hang on, each time you go through it, God is actually with you more than ever. You see what's happening right here? He's with them even more than ever. And that gives me a lot of encouragement. Just encourages me. So Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he talked with. I suspect it was the same stone, since that's where he was at. He was in Bethel. And Jacob set a pillar in the place where he talked with him, even a pillar of stone, and he poured a drink offering thereon, and he poured oil thereon. And that's why I've got to believe that stone became very important and still exists, because this was done in honor to God. And God, you know, when you honor him in a special way like that, he honors you too. And that stone was an honor to him and representative of his relationship between him and Jacob. That stone still exists. And I believe that stone really is the stone of Scone that is in Scotland right now. And it came to pass when she was in heart labor that the midwife said unto her, fear not, you shall have this son also. And it came to pass as her soul was in departing, for she died, that she called his name Ben-Ani. But his father called him Benjamin. And Ben-Ani meant something about sorrow, sadness, bitterness. I can't remember the exact phrase now. Pardon me? Son of my sorrow. Yes. Because I do remember now, Bani is son. But son of my sorrow. Jacob immediately changed his name. That was by God's design. Because remember, all the names of Israel, from what I can understand at this point, I believe all of them pointed in some way to glorify Christ. And so in this case, Jacob changed his name to Son of the Right Hand. Son of the Right Hand. But she says, Son of my sorrow. And when I read this, I got so sad. You know why? Because it wasn't just because she was dying she said that. Rachel had a very sad life. She had been a very unhappy woman. She had fought for her husband's affections for who know how many years with another woman who was fighting for those affections. She had given her handmaid to Jacob. The other woman had given her handmaid to Jacob. She had done all this, and Jacob probably now, here he is, the old man, he's tired. And all those years missed of a relationship that was so much promised at the beginning and failed to be. And she was a very sad woman. And she says, son of my sorrow. And she named him. She was talking about her entire life. That's what she was talking about. And when I read that, it just made me feel so sad as I looked at that. But another lesson as to what happened in that relationship. It didn't work. It did not work. Two wives and two concubines. Look what happened with the sons. And as we read on, jealousy developed between them. And that was probably already there. Rachel knew that. She had Joseph. And Joseph was favored by the father, as we shall see. And all the brothers hated Joseph. She had saw nothing but turmoil. Conflict. All those things was in that family. So she died there and was buried in the way to Ephrath, which is Bethlehem. She died in the place where Christ was to be born. I don't know the significance exactly, but she died where he was supposed to be born, or was born, and was buried in the way to Ephrath, which is Bethlehem. You know, it's kind of interesting. She died in a state of sadness and hopelessness. And where she died was where hope was going to begin in the future. But in her case, she didn't know it right then and there. And Jacob set a pillar upon her grave. That is the pillar of Rachel's grave unto this day. And Israel journeyed and spread his tent beyond the tower of Edar. And it came to pass, when Israel dwelt in the land, that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine. The troubles keep on going. Yes.
I just got a quick question. Do you know why God allowed for all those multiple marriages and concubines, and why did he honor it?
God allowed people to make their own decisions. He allowed free moral agency. And at that particular time, it appears that maybe a lot of the laws that we know about now, they may not have known as strictly as we know it. I don't know, but they may not have. It seems like they were following the custom and traditions that they were associated with at the time. There's a scripture that comes to mind where it talks about God winking at the ignorance of men in the past. And it may very well be that at this time God has winked at a certain amount of ignorance in dealing with them. Yes.
There's also the time in the future, in time of great travail, sometimes there's most of the men are killed off. And sometimes there's in order for women to have husbands, sometimes they're going to share them.
Well, that's true too, and it appears that God actually used that principle in Israel. He actually did do that. And in this case, here he did it. It appears that that law existed at that time. We'll see that with Judah in just a little while, that law existed back then, where if there was not a, if a son married, and plus that law was carried over into Israel under Moses, but if a son married and the son died, then the next nearest son was to father children for him with that particular woman. So it seemed like some of these things were allowed by God at that particular time, even used by him, but what we have to understand is what Christ brought out. It was not the ideal. It was not the ideal that God had purposed from the beginning. But God has allowed various different things that happen over a period of time because, like he said to, Christ said to the Pharisees, because of the hardness of the hearts of men. And you see, when God is dealing with people who are carnal, who do not have his Holy Spirit, he's limited as to what he can do with them. See, with you and I, it's different. We have his Spirit. We are to be completely yielded to God in his total will and purpose. But with people that don't have his Spirit, it's an entirely different thing. And we have to remember, Jacob most of that time was unconverted himself until he wrestled with Christ just before meeting Esau. And it appears that after that, he became converted. Remember when Jacob, later on, as you see, when Jacob asked Joseph to bury him, he told him, bury me with where my father Abraham and Isaac with their wives, and he mentions their wives, and then he says, and where I buried Leah. So he obviously came to the point of understanding that the one who was his legal wife was Leah, and everything that happened after that was not legal. But he didn't have that understanding at the beginning. He just simply didn't. But God dealt with him in spite of that lack of understanding. Yes.
So even though he did honor the marriages of that day, I mean, do you think that he considered it a sin, or were they, or was it not a sin then at that time?
Well, yeah, it was a sin of ignorance. I don't know if you know it, but there are certain sacrifices that God gave to Israel, which were sacrifices for sins of ignorance, meaning what you don't know, and it hasn't been revealed to you. And the blood of those sacrifices would cover you for what you did not know, which tells you something about God. Think about it for a moment. He looks on the heart, the intent, and the attitude of the individual. So even though there's something you might be doing right now that's not right, And you honestly don't know. You really don't know. We're not talking about where you tell yourself, well, I don't know if this is right or wrong, so I'm going to go ahead and do this over here. I don't mean that. I mean something that you're completely, totally oblivious to. God in His due time will reveal it to you. But until then, the Scripture shows that even right now as we walk in and under the blood of Christ. And there are those offerings for sins of ignorance. Okay, yes.
Also, this is before the Ten Commandments, isn't it?
Well, technically before, but not really, because you have to understand that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob had the Ten Commandments. They had the Ten Commandments. If you read back in Genesis 26, verse 4, God talks about His promises to Abraham, and He's talking to Isaac, and He said, because your father kept my commandments and my laws and my statutes. He says that specifically. So there's no doubt in my mind that Abraham knew about the commandments, and he taught those commandments to Isaac. But for whatever reason, Jacob didn't exactly understand some things like he should have, at least for part of his life. Now, after his conversion, it appears that Jacob understood. He understood. So we don't know. It could even be that, maybe Jacob began to favor Leah more in the relationship somewhere down the line, too. Maybe he did. But by the time Rachel died, she was not a happy person. She was not happy. But nevertheless, you can look upon it as being, well, is God inconsistent? No, He's not inconsistent. But He does show latitude. And you know what? I'm glad He does. Because I know I need some latitude. Is there anybody in here that doesn't need latitude? I'd like to know who that is. Because I know I need some latitude with God. And He does show that. And even this is one of the great lessons of what we're reading through here, because even in the midst of some of these mistakes, these sins, and ignorance that is being done here, God is still showing His mercy all at the same time. Yes, Mike.
I think we kind of brought this up last week or week before, but Abraham would not let Isaac go back to Padan Aram or whatever it was. And if Isaac would not have let Jacob go back, if Isaac would have took his servant, sent him back there,
right.
One of them women would have come out that God chose.
Good point.
And it probably would have been Leah, the oldest one maybe. And the story, would have been happy.
Yeah.
But then I'm sure his son would have did something different. So eventually something was
eventually somebody would have done something different. That's another thing I wanted to bring out, just to regress for a moment. That we need to consider. But by the way, that's an excellent point, because if Isaac had done that, if he had done the exact thing that Abraham did, sent his servant, not his son. See, Abraham didn't want to take a chance on Isaac going there and seeing something that, you know, wouldn't have been right for him. Abraham was smart. But see, Isaac didn't think about that, and Isaac kind of panicked a little bit because Esau was threatening to kill Jacob, so he wanted to get him out of Dodge in a hurry. And he made a mistake in doing that. And then what happens? Jacob comes back with four women. You know, and now he's got a real problem. But I want to mention another thing as a little digression. And it relates to us. Can you see that in the midst of this here trial and these difficulties and all these problems that they're having, who is the one causing all this stuff? Don't we know that the enemy was just as much after them as he's after us today? Do you realize, brother, that anyone that God has chosen and God has placed His hands on, it's like putting a bullseye on your back and the devil is aiming an arrow directly at you? Do we realize that? Why do you think, but look at all this turmoil we've seen in his family so far. And we have brethren asking questions today, you know, why is all this stuff happening to God's church? And I've asked the question many times. Why is all this happening to God's church? There's some who come to the point, they've even said, this can't be God's church because of all this mess. It's just no way. Well, I've got a flash for you. It has never been different. It's always been this way. Can we see? Can we see that? It was that way there. Satan the devil was just after them just as much as he is us now. He was after Jacob, he was after Abraham and Isaac, he was after that whole family line. You see what he tried to do to get that amalgamation, to bring in the Canaanites and to cause the idolatry and all the false gods that were in the midst of the family. It was a struggle to keep that situation straight. And it's no different for us today. The turmoil that we see in the church today is no different. And the devil is busy in every way he can to create division, to create conflict, to get us confused, to get us, you know, wary, to cause us to try to flee off on our own in some corner somewhere and cower there, you know, all by ourselves. He's trying to do that. Same thing happened then, it's happening now. It has not changed, and it's going to remain that way down to the time that Christ comes, because why? He's prophesied it. Christ himself prophesied it. He even prophesied a time when the love of many would wax cold. That's what he said. Where people within the church, he was talking about the church, by the way, when people within the church, you know, because of what would be happening around them, they would start saying, it's not a good idea to be associated with these people over here because you could maybe get killed. Or you're going to be looked down upon. You're going to be ostracized and say, oh, I won't have a job tomorrow. So I don't know you. I don't know you. We don't know, brethren, this thing is going to get, you know, we think this is bad now. This is not bad. There's a lot more trouble yet down the road because we have an enemy that is angry with the chosen ones of God. You know why? Brethren, you're going to take his place. The rulership that he has now, you're going to take it. He knows that. Do you think he's happy about that? And he's not going to give it up without a fight. You're a personal, direct threat to him and his demons. Because all of them are going to be locked up. And the very positions and responsibility of rulership that they presently have right now, they won't have anymore. So they knew that Abraham was going to be taking over rulership of the world. They knew that Isaac and Jacob, Joseph, and now us. They know that. So they know who to attack. They're not that concerned about the rest of the world out there. And I'm going to tell you something. I've said it before. I don't know how many of you believe it, but it's true. I'm telling you, it's the most true thing you will ever hear. But all of the turmoil that you see in this world, brethren, is all designed ultimately to get to the church of God. It really is. Every bit of it. It's all little stages being set up in the end so that once you get all the political forces together and all the other secular and religious forces together, they are coming after us. And that's Satan's whole goal, his whole thing. All the movements that you see out there, one way or another, is to set the stage to persecute the people of God. That's Satan's goal. He's got them already. He doesn't have to work to get them. It's you he wants to destroy. And just like we see what's happening here with all this stuff going on, well, this is normal. This is normal. Now, if all this stuff is not going on, that's the time to get real worried. That's the time to be worried. I mean, if stuff isn't happening, it's time to start wondering, you know, things have been a little too calm here for too long. What's about to come up here, you know? You can just about bet Satan the devil's setting you up real good. It really is. It's nice to have peace, but I tell you, I almost feel more comfortable with turmoil. Because then you know where you're at. But let's go on here. Rachel dies. And we read where Reuben goes up to his father's concubine and commits adultery with her, lays with her. And then it goes on and says here, and the sons of Leah were Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, and Simeon, and Levi, and Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. Those are all the ones born by Leah. And the sons of Rachel, Joseph, and Benjamin. Then the ones that were born by the concubines, Bilhah, Rachel's handmaid, was Dan and Naphtali. And the sons of Zilpah, the other handmaid, which was Leah's handmaid, Gad and Asher. These are the sons of Jacob, which were born to him in Padan Aram. Yes.
How
Okay, there's an inconsistency here.
Okay, what is it?
Now, it says here at the end of verse 22, now the sons of Jacob were 12. Now, if you go over to chapter 22 in Genesis, and if you read verse 16, I guess you can choose that, and God's talking about Abraham sacrificing his only son, and we know he had Ishmael, and that was by a concubine.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a contradiction here. Help
no,
me with that
no contradiction. No contradiction. I explained this before in chapter 22, and what I explained there when it says only son, only legitimate son recognized by God. Ishmael, he still blessed him. And that was a physical son, but like the scripture says, in fact, a good place to read, let's read there now. It's over in Romans, I think. Let's go there. Because Romans really kind of explains it, I think, better than I can attempt to do so. I think, what is that, Romans 11 or is it 10? I thought it was 11, but maybe I'm wrong. Let's see. Maybe it's 9. Let's check 9 out here. I think it's 9. That's one of them. That's not the one I was looking for. Oh, let's go up to... Let's start at verse 7. Let's start at verse 5. 9. Romans 9. Let's start at verse 4. Who are the Israelites? To whom pertains the sonship? That word adoption should be translated sonship. To who pertains the sonship? You see, in the eyes of God, in the way He's working out His plan, Israel is not the sonship. Ishmael. Neither is Esau. They are not the sonship. Now, they're children, physically, of Jacob. But when God is thinking of the line that He's working with, He does not count them as sons. And in the case of Esau, he was the physical firstborn. But in the eyes of God, Jacob was the firstborn. You understand what I'm saying? Let's read it a little further because it explains it. To whom pertains the sonship and the glory and the covenants and the giving of the law and the service of God and the promises? Now, all these things went to whom? The firstborn child. It's whom it was supposed to go to. In the case of Jacob, he was not the firstborn. And even in the case of some of Jacob's other children, they didn't get this. It went to someone else like Joseph, who was not the firstborn. So going on, it says, whose are the fathers, or whom as concerning the flesh, Christ came, who is over all, God blessed forever. Amen. Not as though the word of God has not taken none effect, for they are not all Israel which are of Israel. So he's using this to make an analogy even on the spiritual level, that not all physical Israelites are looked at as being Israelites by God, even though they're physically Israelite. But in God's eyes, that's not necessarily the ones who really are Israel. And in the same way with Ishmael, when it said his only son and left Ishmael out of the equation, it was saying that from the perspective of the way God viewed it because of the son of promise. Let me go on a little further. It says, neither because they are the seed of Abraham are they all children. That's pretty plain there too. It says here, but in Isaac shall your seed be called. So back in Genesis 22, when it was saying Abraham's only son, this is how it's relating it. This is why you have to take one part of scripture from someplace else and put it all together, and you get the whole thing there, see? And it works out. So, yes, go ahead. That's exactly right. In fact, isn't that the next scripture here too? Yeah, it is. The next scripture actually says what Leela just said. He's the son of promise. It goes on, verse 8, that is, they which are the children of flesh, these are not the children of God, but the children of promise are counted for the seed. And that's why it speaks that way in Genesis. And, I had mentioned that the last time. The reason I was bringing that out the last time is to show how God's salvation and His plan and all of that is being revealed in Genesis And all Paul is doing is taking it from Genesis and expounding on it. That's what Paul is doing. You know, really all the New Testament really is, in fact, is exposition of the Old Testament. That's why it's so ridiculous that some people want to throw out the Old Testament today, which is really ridiculous. But the New Testament is exposition, inspired preaching by the apostles from the Old Testament. So anyway, does that clear it up?
Yeah, it's coming back to me. I got like SAT or something.
So that's how that works. And going back here now to, where were we? Still in chapter 35? Well, we finish up 35 pretty much. There's nothing else much to say in 35. Just names the sons of Jacob. And it names them, you know, in respect to, well, his sons. These are the sons of Jacob. And Jacob came unto Isaac his father, unto Mamre, unto the city of Arba, which is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac sojourned. And the days of Isaac were 180 years. So Isaac actually lived 5 years more than even Abraham. He lived to be 180 years old, which makes Jacob 120 years old at this point. Because Isaac was 60 years old when those two boys were born. Remember we read that earlier? So Jacob himself is an old man at this point as well. He's 120 years old. And Isaac gave up the ghost of the spirit and died and was gathered unto his people, being old and full of days. I love that expression because what it implies was his life was complete. His life was complete. Not just merely because of the years he lived, but because of the total sum total of experience in his life, it was complete for him. And so the length of time is not so much the most important thing, but what is the most important thing is how we grow and develop and what God does with us in our lives. So when we reach the end of it, our lives are complete in what God would have for us. And his life was complete. And his sons, Esau and Jacob, buried him. Then it gives in chapter 36, we'll skip that because we've dealt with it before when we went through the book of Ezekiel. And of course, we've dealt with it a little earlier when we were in Genesis about Esau and his lineage or genealogy. And the reason why the Bible gives these extensive genealogies, once again, God not only uses Israel, Israel's prime, but he also uses other nations too as signposts in relationship to Israel. Because many of these nations are also, in one way or another, interacting with Israel. And God uses these nations as signposts in the Bible for anyone that has the determination to do so, to do the research. You can take these various different names of these people in here, and if you have those scholarly skills and the capacities of a scribe, and we need a few of those, then you can go into these things and dig into history, dig into those dusty books that are kept in faraway places, and dig up this information, and you will find these names, and you'll be able to trace them to where they came from and where they started, and you find out that the Bible is true. Now, I don't have those skills, so what I do is I utilize those who do have the skills. And there are plenty of people still around, and you know, it's an amazing thing. God has made sure that there are people around that have done the research and have those skills. And I recommend going to originofnations.com. on the internet, and you can get a lot of good information from there. Now, I don't agree with all of his philosophy, though. And that's Craig White that runs that particular website. But I don't agree with all of Craig's philosophy. But his information on where the races are, where they've gone, is really very good. Very good. Then there's Dr. Herman Hayes' compendium, and now that is available on CD, showing where many of the races have gone, tracing this information, some excellent scholarship that has been done there. And I think they're getting better all the time. They're finding out more information all the time. And God has always maintained people with those particular gifts. The Bible calls it the gift of knowledge. And there are people who have that gift for knowledge that way. And we need that. And then when you find that out, then this book just becomes so awesome even more. Now you know where these people are. And then when you read these specific prophecies, you know where to look. Turkey's our friend today, but it's not going to stay that way. You understand that, don't you? Because the Turkeys are primarily and predominantly the Edomites. Then there are other Edomites that are throughout the Arab world, intermixed among the Ishmaelites. And the Bible has prophesied the Edomites And the Israelites are going to be completely against Israel. They already are against Judah, but they're going to be against Israel. And look like the Israelites predominantly right now against Israel as well. And look who's coming into play with the Iraq war. Who? Ephraim and Manasseh are the two ones leading the charge. Are they going to love us for that? And what's going to happen down the line? Are they going to forget that? See, they are vengeful people too. It's not just it ain't just the Irish that got that flaw. They're vengeful people too. And they will not forget. Believe me. That's why they could wait. Look what they did. They bombed the tower. What was the Trade Towers bombed? Was it 92? 93 the first time? 10 years they waited, almost. They were willing to patiently wait 10 years to pull that off. You don't think they're planning right now? Oh, sure, they know that we're very alert right now. They know it's tough right now. But they say, you know, those Americans, they're so confident and arrogant in their ability to do this, they'll forget. We'll wait. Let the arrogant Americans think they've got it all covered. And then we'll just sneak in a few operatives with just a couple of suitcases. You know, two guys take down the whole country. I'm kind of worried right now, brethren, about this here viruses that are attacking these here cruise ships and some other stuff. I'm really concerned. I'm getting concerned. Because this stuff has been a little strange, the way this is happening. And now it's not only attacking cruise ship, one of the aircraft carriers has it. And I'm beginning to wonder about whether or not they've released some kind of biological stuff out here. And by the way, this particular disease they're catching, they say is fatal if not treated quickly. So I'm kind of wondering, and you know, it's strange. And you know, when I was reading just the other day, this I think it was an aircraft carrier, I believe it was, in which is broken out on there.
The Roosevelt.
The Roosevelt?
Yeah.
The Roosevelt, yeah. So this is rather strange. Why, you know, what is happening here? You know, let me tell you, these people have no conscience about unleashing this stuff. And then I hear our politicians talk about, and we're going to end it here. We won't go through any more in the Bible. We'll go to chapters 38 and on 37, 38 on, deal with the story and the great adventure of Joseph, because it's one of the great stories of the Bible. Really, just a fantastic story. We'll deal with that. But I just wonder, brethren, what's going on with this deal. And some people are really, you know, against the president about going into Iraq. But I tell you something. Do you realize, brethren, that in that report that the Iraqis released, that it was something like, I believe it was 40 or 50 tons, I can't remember the exact amount, of anthrax that's missing? Anthrax? And they don't have in the report what they did with it and where it's at. And people are upset with the president about wanting to go into Iraq? You don't think that country's dangerous? Is there anybody here in their right mind think they are not in cahoots with the terrorists? Please give me a break. And then I hear some of our politicians talking this stuff. Well, we don't know if they really, you know, have weapons of mass destruction. The president hasn't showed us any evidence. And I said to myself, what's wrong with these folks' brains? Why would he show evidence to give it away to everybody before we can get a tag on this thing? Remember the old saying back in World War II, they used to have loose lips sink ships? We have forgot that simple little equation. And you got these here real smart politicians. Smart, you know what I mean? Smart. who are sitting up talking about, well, you know, the president, you know, we feel this is not good. This, you know, we shouldn't do this. We must follow the United Nations. When have they ever been united? Ever. I mean, I just get so upset. I've been upset all week. I've been listening to this stuff and listening to all the stuff that they have actually and I forgot about the nerve gas. And also, not only the nerve gas, that was in the tons too. Missing. And get this, hundreds of these casings, aluminum casings for uranium for building an atomic bomb. They're missing. So the president did release a little bit of information. He couldn't release everything yet, but he did release a little bit to the United Nations yesterday about the mobile vehicles, which are laboratories, chemical laboratories, and they have them in trailer houses. So they can move them around. But we know about them. We know where they are. We know where they've been moving them to. But we wanted to give the inspectors time to see if they would really do their job. Also to see if the Iraqis would tell the truth. Obviously, they have not. By the way, you know, much of the Iraqis population is not Ishmaelite, it's Edomite. Esau. And so we're talking about prophecy once again coming into play. They're going to be a thorn in the side of Israel right down to the end. And this thing is heating up. You know, all these years we thought it was a war between the communist nations and NATO. But no, it's the same old war that existed back hundreds of years ago between the Muslims and the Christians. The same old one. And the Bible shows it's going to heat up. That's why the Bible puts all this stuff in here. And to let you know and me know upon those upon whom the ends of the world have come, so that you can have this here privilege of knowing that the God that you serve is sovereign and true. And you can watch and pray a lot. A whole lot. But anyways, 2:30, yes, yes, Diane. Yes, I went to the website that night, and what she said was true. Europeans, the European Economic Community, has been given rights now to form their own military force, sort of like a rapid deployment force, like what we're doing now. Like we're going to go into Iraq and so forth. Well, they are being given that kind of sanction by the UN. To be able to do the same thing, to go into various hot spots and trouble spots and places like that with their military. And we've paved the way for it, actually, by what the United States has done, like when we went into Iraq before and, you know, and other things we've done. We've opened the door for them to have now the excuse to do the same thing. And each one of them are committing so many troops to it. I forgot, I think Germany was 2,000 troops, France, so many thousands, and each one of them committing so many troops to this so they could have this rapid deployment force. Well, that's no more than a prelude to an army for Europe. That's what that is. It's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Yes, Gunnar.
And that force is being headed by Germany.
Yeah, it's being headed by Germany. That's right. That's true. It's being headed by Germany. And that's another thing that is really hair-raising. That's hair-raising because if we know prophecy, remember, and we know that what the role that Assyria is to play in prophecy, and who is Assyria? Well, we can trace them too. The Bible gives us the various names and the names of the different tribes of the Assyriani and where they traveled between the Black and Caspian Seas and across the Caucasus into Europe. And they actually, during the time of the Assyrian Empire, a lot of people don't know this, the Assyrian Empire actually extended up into Europe. Extended up into Europe. So they had people there already.
Mm-hmm. Also, another thing, I don't know if you notice, but if you come this way from Evergreen, there's now Islamic Studies.
Is it really?
Yes. University up the street.
Yes. Okay.
Does Germany still control our everything?
I don't know. I had heard that, but I don't know if that's true or not. I'd heard somebody mention that they patrol our airspace. But I don't know. I know that they have Germans that have been here that are at our Air Force, Air Force academies and stuff like that. And I know that they have flown our planes here in this country, but whether or not they had been given privileges to patrol our airspace or not, I didn't know if that was true or not.
I found it on a GTA website.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
And they patrol our airspace?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Unreal. Unreal. Yes, Carly.
So with this recent development, do we have the 10 toes yet?
No, we don't have that yet. We have, it's about 20 nations right now. But you know what? That's going to eventually, some of those nations, I believe, in the East are going to end up breaking off and going to the back to the East. Are going to be aligned up with Russia, China, other Eastern nations, especially those Eastern nations that are Muslim. I don't see them remaining in that configuration. In fact, I know they're not going to remain in that configuration because the Bible has let us know there's going to be 10 toes and that there's going to be the 10 horns in the end. And so that there will end up being 10 nations with a king over them. Yes.
Kind of small detail, but we're on the subject. These put significance that there's two legs also.
Exactly.
And, do you have any thoughts on that? Or?
Yeah, I think that is significant because, you know, even the Roman Empire had an eastern and a western leg. And I think we will have the same thing. So some of those eastern states will remain, because you think of Poland as Catholic. Romania is predominantly Catholic. Greek is Greek Orthodox. They may not necessarily go back toward the West. Plus, they're terrified of the Muslims. So when you start looking at the geography, you can almost just about pick the nations that will probably stay with the West because they're heavily Catholic. So really what you're going to see is the traditional Holy Roman Catholic regions that existed in the past, I believe. That's my own speculation. That's what you're going to end up seeing. That's going to be most of Europe, really, you know, that are make up those two legs. And then you have that eastern leg that'll go only so far, though, because then when you get into places like Turkey certainly is that eastern point that I don't think you're going to go past that. That's Esau. And there are some other Muslim countries that are right along that geographic front that are also Muslim. So they probably are not going to go for the West as well. The Bible shows that the king of the north is going to come against the Muslim nations, the king of the south. And that's who the king of the south is, the Muslim nations. So that, you know, this thing is lying all up. And most people don't understand the Muslim faith. They don't know that it's part of their movement to try to make everyone Muslim. And that's exactly what they're doing. How many of you know that the fastest growing religion in America is the Muslim religion? Did you know that? It's the fastest growing religion in America. Christianity can't keep up with it. Now, you know that can't keep going on like that unless there's going to be a conflict at some point. And there will. There will be. There's going to be a clash. And we're talking about a clash of two different civilizations and philosophies. They cannot exist side by side. It's going to happen. And we're headed toward it real rapidly here and pretty fast. And I don't know. I just can't see a whole lot of years before, you know, we really hit the skids completely. I just can't see a lot of years yet ahead of us. There's too much going on. How can you contain all that? Now, I know God can contain anything he wants. So, you know, I know Lord. So I know he can contain anything he wants. But just looking at it from our human capacity, you know that this just cannot humanly be contained very long. Something's going to give. That's why it's so important to understand these here things about the different nations. We see prophecy unfolding. You know who they are. You know the Bible said about them. You know what they're going to do. We have those details. Tell me, brother, and I said my last words for today. What other people have been given so great a privilege? There are no others. There's nobody else even studying it from that point of view at all. Number one, they don't even know where Israel is at. They don't even know where they're at. Not alone where Esau is and Ishmael is and Assyria is and, you know, and Cush and Gomer and Meshach and Tubal. Well, it's quite a few scholars know who Meshach and Tubal. They know they're Russian. That's about all they know, though. They don't know much else. So God has really blessed us with this. And so we're going to end it for today, and we'll go into the other chapters next week. Or we may just have an open Bible study next week. Maybe we'll do that.
Excuse me, I'd like to ask a question.
Yes, ma'am.
Some time ago, I heard that Dr. Hay himself had said that his compendium was not correct. Have you heard anything about that?
No, ma'am, I haven't heard anything about Dr. Hay saying that, but I've heard some others in the church have said that they feel that it's not correct. And there may be, no doubt, some things in it that possibly may not be correct, because we are growing in knowledge and information, and as we do so, I have no doubt that certain corrections are being made. But I believe a great deal of Dr. Hay's information, from a general perspective, is correct. Now, I've compared his book. I've read both volumes of his compendium, Compendium 1 and 2. And I've compared his works to some of the other works that are being done today, like Craig White's works and some of the scholars with him on Origin of Nations and some of the research they have recently done. And on some of the most recent information, it corroborates a lot of the stuff that Dr. Hay has in his book. Now, some things are more accurate, though, than what Dr. Hay gave in his compendium. So it's a good idea to make comparisons if you have that kind of time. But it's not like his book is a complete disaster, by no means. There's a lot of good information that is there. But I can't say it's 100%. Maybe it's 80% accurate.
Thank you. I've just been wondering about that. And mm-hmm.
Okay, you're more than welcome. By the way, anyone who wants to look at Dr. Hay's compendiums, you can get the disc now. In fact, you can get it from the Ultimate Church of God website. Ultimate Church of God website. I think it's called the Ultimate Church of God. Is that what it's called? The Ultimate, something like that.
Universal?
No, Ultimate. It says Ultimate... the Ultimate Church of God website, I think it is. I think that's what it is. It doesn't mean the name of the church is the Ultimate Church. It's referring to all the things you can get there.
But if you could just put in search Ultimate Church in the church.
It should come up. It'll come up if you put a search on it, yeah. It'll come up. In fact, I found it that way. And if you find that website, they do have either the CD, or you can actually download from their website the complete compendium of Dr. Hay 1 and 2. You can download it to your computer, which I've done, download to the computer. I used to have the books years ago, and I don't know, I gave them to somebody, and I never got them back. And that must have been about 25 years or so ago. Never got them back. And for years, I've wanted to get those books back, and but now it's readily available for anybody now. And they got the CDs. So a lot of good information in there. But again, as Leela brought out, it's not 100% because we've grown in knowledge. We've grown in knowledge now, and there's more information. But it's a good place to start. Okay, we're going to stop service today. Have one last song.